Again, I want to thank all of you for having me here. It's a great honor and privilege to be able to deliver these lectures on the theology of numbers. And you all have been very hospitable. I had the joy of working out with Miles this morning. I think he was having a good day. He was able to spot me for some of my warm-ups. It's been great being here, and I've been encouraged in just getting to know some of you students as well. We pray regularly at our house for God to keep raising up servants for the field. And so it's a great encouragement of the work of God's Spirit, and that the gospel will go forth and Christ's kingdom will stretch throughout the ends of the earth. And so we rejoice in your own progress. Well, today for our third lecture, we're going to look at the purity laws of the camp of Israel. And that brings us to chapters 5 and 6 of Numbers. And primarily, I want to look at the context and the function of these purity laws. Perhaps the leading view in mainstream scholarship is that these laws are out of place. They're not related to one another, and much less so related to the surrounding context of the book of Numbers. These laws were actually added to Numbers, so the theory goes, because, for example, the book of Leviticus had already become closed and stable canonically. It was complete as a book, while Numbers had not yet been closed and complete. And so these scholars view the book of Numbers to be the very last book of the Pentateuch to have closed canonically. And so Numbers therefore became what some scholars refer to as a dumping ground or a repository of priestly legislation. There's things you want in Scripture, there was no place for them elsewhere, you just throw them into Numbers, and that's why you can't make rhyme or reason of the book. Well, needless to say, such a view of these purity laws has tended to mitigate any kind of scholarly effort toward trying to figure out the logic of these laws, how they relate to one another, what their theology is, and how these laws relate to the flow and the context of the book of Numbers itself. As noted in our first lecture, however, a lot of the questions that surface, so how do these laws relate to one another, how do they relate to the book of Numbers, answers surface once we realize that it's the camp of Israel itself that is the integrating and organizing principle for all of the material in Numbers 1 through 10. And within that context, we find a theological progression. So from Numbers 1 to 4, the physical arrangement of the camp leads naturally into Numbers 5 and 6 with a view to the spiritual essence and life of the camp given to us through these purity laws in Numbers 5 and 6. Furthermore, if it's true that Israel's camp stands as the first historic expression and paradigm of the ideal covenant community, then likely these purity laws of Numbers 5 and 6 are paradigmatic just as well as the camp itself. So to understand the role and function of these purity laws in Numbers 5 through 6, what I want to do together is to begin first of all with a general overview. And in that overview, we'll go over the basic content and summary of these purity laws and also give a look at their structure. And then after that general overview, I want to give you three ways in which these purity laws function in relation to the spiritual essence and life of Israel's camp. And so let's begin first with a general overview of the purity laws in Numbers 5 and 6. For the sake of orienting ourselves to this section, I want to read for us the very first of Yahweh's 5 speeches that comprise these 2 chapters. So I'll be reading from Numbers 5, 1 through 4. And Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, "Command the sons of Israel that they send away from the camp all who are leprous, all with a bodily discharge, and all who are defiled by a corpse. Male and female alike you are to send away to outside the camp. You will send them away, so they do not defile their camps in the midst of which I myself am dwelling." Just so did the sons of Israel do. They sent them away to outside the camp, just as Yahweh had spoken to Moses. Just so the sons of Israel did. So beginning with a basic summary of the camp's purity laws, Numbers 5 through 6 comprise 5 speeches from Yahweh to Moses for the sake of Israel's camp. And the first speech, which I just read, Numbers 5, 1 through 4, serves as the prologue to the purity laws. And then the last speech, Numbers 6, 22 through 27, you'll recognize as the priestly benediction, and that serves as a conclusion, not only to the purity laws, but to the whole section, Numbers 1 through 6 as a whole. So the final speech, the priestly blessing, identifies this newly constructed camp of Israel, the one place where God dwells with humanity, as the place of blessing. And that's, of course, going to serve as a motivation to live a life of purity, because you want to be within that one realm that is blessed by the Lord. But for our purposes, putting aside the prologue, Numbers 5, 1 through 4, and then the conclusion, Numbers 6, 22 through 27, leaves us with three speeches by Yahweh. So you have first the law concerning restitution for oath breakers, chapter 5, 5 through 10. Secondly, the law concerning the strayed woman, chapter 5, 11 through 31. And then thirdly, the law concerning the Nazirite vow, chapter 6, 1 through 21. Now, these laws are unified by key terms and themes, some of which I'll bring out in the process of going through this lecture with you. But to take one example, so the prologue relates to male and female alike, chapter 5, verse 3. And we find that each of these purity laws, we have similar language. So a man or a woman, chapter 5, 6. A man whose wife goes astray, chapter 5, 12. And a man or a woman, chapter 6, 2. And then, of course, the priestly benediction is for all the people of God. And again, other examples will be offered as we proceed. But now, for the sake of discussion, let me just give you a very brief summary of those three main purity cases. So the law for restitution, chapter 5, 5 through 10. This law provides resolution to an act of unfaithfulness or treachery against Yahweh, but specifically in relation to one's neighborly dealings within Israelite society, that is, within the context of one's interrelationships with others in the camp. And the law assumes the scenario of Leviticus 6, namely somebody finds or squanders another person's deposit or security, and in the process, he or she swears a false oath in Yahweh's name to cover up the act. And it's this false oath in Yahweh's name that constitutes this sin as treachery against Yahweh. And so restitution requires the guilty person to confess the sin and offer a sacrifice of atonement. He or she is to make restitution in full to the offended person, adding a fifth. And then thirdly, the law stipulates that in the event where the offended person or their family are no longer alive, then that restitution goes to Yahweh by means of giving it to his priest. Secondly, the law for the strayed woman, chapter 5, 11 through 31. This law deals with the scenario whereby a woman has strayed into seclusion with another man. And there's no witnesses as to what happened in that seclusion. So this law isn't about adultery per se, but about purity. The question is whether or not she has become unclean by another man's seed, and consequently, it also relates to the issue of establishing paternity in the event of a pregnancy. And at the center of this ritual, the woman must affirm an oath of malediction before Yahweh. So this is one of the things we'll see in each of these three case laws. They all involve some sort of oath or great vow. Thirdly, the law of the Nazirite vow, chapter 6, 1 through 21. So this law allows a man or a woman to vow a vow of separation, Hebrew, natsir, where we get the word Nazirite from. And this is for a set period of time, and it's in order to separate him or herself unto God. And so during the period of this separation, the Nazirite is to abstain from grape products, from cutting his or her hair, and from coming into contact with a corpse, even for the sake of a funeral of a close family member. Now, in the event of accidental corpse pollution, the Nazirite is to undergo a rite of cleansing. He has to shave his or her hair, and then he starts that period all over again with the same three abstentions. And then, as we'll see in a moment, this vow culminates with this ritual whereby the Nazirite's shorn hair is placed upon the altar as a sacrifice. And we'll come back to some of those details in a moment. But now let me move on in this general summary to the structure of the camp's purity laws. And this, I hope, is where your handouts will be of some use to you. It can get a little dizzying the further we get into this part. So to appreciate more deeply how these laws relate to the camp, we need to rehearse for a moment the architecture of the wilderness camp as delineated in Numbers 1 through 4. So remember that the camp in the wilderness is comprised of basically three concentric squares, And we can think of each of these squares as its own camp. So at the heart of the camp, we have Yahweh's tent and courtyard. This is the camp of the Shekinah. Next, we have the encampment of the Levites in their square around Yahweh's camp, and they comprise the inner camp, or the camp of the Levites. And then finally, we have the 12 tribes encamping at a distance from Yahweh's tent and the Levites, and this is called the outer camp, or the camp of the 12 tribes. Also important, these three camps comprise concentric spheres of holiness. So beginning, of course, with the central camp of the Shekinah, the Holy of Holies, then extending outward by degrees, camp by camp, you have varying degrees of holiness all the way to you hit the last square, the camp of the 12 tribes. Now, here's where it gets interesting. The threefold structure of Israel's camp appears to be paralleled by the purity laws of Numbers 5 through 6. Jewish interpretations on these purity laws correlate them theologically with the three concentric camps of the wilderness camp. And some scholars refer to this as the three-camp hermeneutic. So to explore this idea, let's begin broadly just by considering the triadic patterns that we find in the purity laws. So notice with me first the prologue, Numbers 5, 1 through 4, calls for a threefold expulsion: those who are lepers, those with a bodily discharge, and those who become polluted by a corpse. And then after the prologue, again, we have three exemplary cases: those needing to make restitution, the wayward woman, and then the Nazirite. And finally, the material culminates with the priestly benediction, which has a clear threefold structure based upon a threefold use of the divine name. Now getting into the details a little bit, beginning with the prologue, the traditional understanding, interpretation, understands that those defiled with leprosy are expelled from all three camps. So beginning with the center, lepers are expelled from the camp of the Shekinah, then the camp of the Levites, and the camp of the 12 tribes. Then secondly, those with the bodily discharge are expelled only from the first two camps, the camp of the Shekinah, the camp of the Levites. And then those defiled by a corpse are only excluded from the first camp, the camp of the Shekinah. It's an interesting suggestion. It does seem to correlate with what we read about purity laws in other places. For example, a leper is much more defiling than someone who is defiled by corpse pollution. The reason being is that a leper himself becomes a fountain of defilement. He can defile other people, whereas the person who has been defiled by a corpse, he himself does not become a source of defilement to others. And so there's degrees. One common exegetical point that interpreters who embrace this three-camp hermeneutic bring out is the purpose clause in 5:3. It states, so they do not defile their camps, plural. And that seems to have an awareness that we have different camps that we're speaking about here. But continuing, the three main cases may also be correlated to the three camps theologically. So first, the need for restitution to one's neighbor deals with relationships in the broader community of Israel, and this relates to the outer camp of the 12 tribes. Then you have the ritual for the wayward woman, including a potential pregnancy, and this deals with relationships in the family. And this would relate to the inner camp of the Levites, and recall that the Levites represent the firstborn of each family. And then thirdly, the Nazirite law deals with personal piety, one's relationship with Yahweh God, and this, of course, would deal with the camp of the Shekinah. And so theologically, it's been understood that the camp of Israel represents three social spheres. First, one's individual relationship with Yahweh God in the center. Then one's relationship within the family, symbolized by the second camp. And then finally, one's relationship in broader Israelite society under God, symbolized by the third camp, the camp of the 12 tribes. Now, to go a little bit further, and again, here I hope the handout will be helpful. This three-camp hermeneutic also correlates the threefold expulsion of the prologue with the three main purity cases. So beginning with the expulsion of lepers, this is often correlated to the case of restitution for false oath taking. And admittedly, it's difficult to perceive any sort of meaningful link here. The rabbis, however, understood leprosy not simply as some sort of a natural affliction, but particularly as a judgment of God, and a judgment of God for what they refer to as an evil tongue. So blasphemy, slander, gossip. And they use that judgment on an evil tongue to correlate it with the false oath. In any case, one would be tempted to dismiss this idea if it weren't for the strength of the next two. So secondly, the expulsion for a bodily discharge is connected to the case of the wayward woman. And this is a firm correlation since the ritual turns on whether or not she's become defiled by another man's seed. And then thirdly, the expulsion for corpse pollution is correlated to the Nazirite vow, also a firm connection because, of course, the main part of this law deals with the Nazirite's remedy for corpse pollution. Then turning finally to the priestly benediction, it's widely observed that the blessing expands incrementally from 3 words to 5 words to 7 words, and then from 15 consonants to 20 to 25, conveying the idea that Yahweh's blessing in the light of his face pours forth incrementally in 3 different stages from the center of the camp till it reaches the outer camp of the Israelites, encompassing the whole camp. And so such a threefold outward blessing pouring forth increasingly from the center has led to many thinking that it correlates pretty well with this three-camp hermeneutic, even without necessarily limiting a particular blessing to one particular camp. But for our purposes, I'm just trying to show you that this material has been crafted very intentionally. It's very beautifully put together. It's shaped for its literary context. And let's simply observe that these three main purity cases call for a purity of living in every sphere of life, in society, in family, and in one's personal piety and relationship with God. So even a dim correlation between the prologue and the three cases that follow demonstrate that Yahweh God was not concerned merely with ritual impurity, but also with moral purity. And he was very concerned about the conduct of life his people had before his face in the camp. So having surveyed a little bit the content and the structure, we're going to turn now to look at the function of these purity laws together. And I've got 3 functions that I want to bring out. So first of all, purity laws function, 1, to reflect the new status of Israel as a camp. And in many ways, this is the most obvious. So Numbers 5 begins with the expulsion of unclean persons from the camp. Why, scholars ask, insert such legislation at just this point? The answer is because in Numbers 1 through 4, the camp has just been created. This isn't rocket science. I actually get paid for this. Numbers 5 is the first possible and logical place to insert concerns over the camp's purity because the camp has just been established. But more than this, these purity laws unveil the new and sobering reality, the new status of God's people, that they have been organized as a camp and they are a new reality, as we looked at yesterday. So previously, the Israelites did not have Yahweh God dwelling in their midst. Yes, they had God's dwelling, the tent of meeting, and Leviticus gives us purity laws that are primarily concerned with God's tent and the Israelites approaching his tent in worship, lest anyone defile his dwelling. It's still a concern in Numbers, the defilement of God's dwelling, but we see that that concern has extended now to the rest of the camp incrementally. So Numbers 5 through 6, these laws serve rather to convey the new and wondrous reality that Yahweh's presence is in the camp and how that presence affects the camp and how the camp affects his central dwelling. And so we have the concern for purity and cleanness increased now to cover the entire camp. And there really is no better way to demonstrate the beautiful reality of this covenant community than to insert purity laws at just this point upon the creation of the camp itself by expelling the unclean from the camp. That lets you know something new has happened. Suddenly these people, just by their arrangement around God's dwelling, have entered into a new reality, so suddenly you have to expel those who are unclean. And so these verses function to give us the nature of Israel's camp, affirming that it's been established as a new covenant community and that God is dwelling in their midst. Now, upon reflection, surely it would have been a bit anticlimactic for the first historical expression of the covenant community to include no further word about the nature of this mobile city of God. That is, without these purity laws here, you could easily read through the book of Numbers and think to yourself that the tribe of Reuben, for example, is in no position different than it was before Numbers 1 through 4, and yet nothing could be further from the truth. The tribe of Reuben has been brought into this cosmos with God dwelling in the center, the light of his face and blessing pouring out to the extent of it, so that they're in a different position now after Numbers 4 than they were before Numbers 1. And one way to convey that new reality for each of the tribes is to include these purity laws again at just this point. All right, secondly, the purity laws function to regulate, number two, regulate the life of Israel's camp. And what I mean here is that the purity laws of Numbers 5 and 6 function to set forth a theology for the life of Israel as a covenant community. And so these laws have a paradigmatic function. We've already had occasion to note that these laws solicit a purity of life within the covenant community that go well beyond mere concerns with ritual impurity. Rather, these laws call for things like confession of sin to one's neighbor, fidelity within one's marriage, selfless devotion to Yahweh God. And as such, they function to regulate the life of Israel's camp and really God's covenant community throughout the ages, as we will see. Numbers 5 through 6 set forth a comprehensive vision for the life of God's people in this newly established covenant community. And in all, we can say that life within the camp is one lived coram Deo, before the face of God, whereby Yahweh himself is involved in every single relationship and interaction in the community. And this is brought out by the function of the priests in every one of these cases, because they, of course, function as representatives of the Lord himself. And such life, again, culminates with the priestly blessing of God. What I'd like to do to demonstrate this point is to take one example and look at the Nazirite vow at some length with you together. So let's consider the Nazirite vow. The Nazirite, who again may be a man or a woman, is to be contrasted with the wayward woman of Numbers 5, 11 through 31. So in terms of paradigmatic function, the wayward woman and the Nazirite present before us two divergent paths before the camp of Israel. These are two different ways of responding to Yahweh God, and so they're paradigmatic and exemplary of the ways you can respond to Yahweh. As such, that means that the wayward woman and the Nazirite vow should always be read together and interpreted together. I spent many months on the wayward woman. The literature is extensive, and there's a lot of course, feminist scholars writing about this, and one of the major fundamental problems is that they divorce the wayward woman's legislation from its context. And so you don't have any of the helps of context. They're also not comparing it to the Nazirite, who again can also be a female, and say, hey, these are two options for an Israelite woman. So we're going to look at it in the context, the Nazirite vow and the wayward woman together. And one of the ways that we know that we should read these together is because they share a lot of common words and themes that betray the intention that we read them together. I'll point out just a few here. First of all, it's been long noted that in this whole section, it's only these two cases that really have the same length. These are the two long cases of comparable length. Secondly, both the strayed woman and the Nazirite are brought, Hebrew hekriv, before Yahweh. Both scenarios, number three, underscore the person's hair as part of the ritual. The woman's hair is loosened using the Hebrew root para in 5:18, and the same root is also used to describe the Nazirite's locks of hair in 6:5. And these are the only two uses of that root in the entire book. Fourthly, both accounts turn on an oath or vow before Yahweh. Fifthly, the result of defilement in each case is described similarly as a falling away, using the Hebrew word nafal. So the wayward woman's thigh falls, and then the Nazirite's days fall, nafal, in both cases. Sixthly, the priest waves or elevates offerings on behalf of both the strayed woman and the Nazirite. And then seventh, both accounts end with the statement, "This is the Torah." Now, Gordon Wenham, in his brilliant little commentary on Numbers, perceived the exemplary function of these laws when he wrote, quote, Thus, as marriage symbolized the relationship between God and Israel, Numbers 5, so the Nazarites epitomized the holy calling of the nation in Numbers 6. Now, without pursuing, again, the various issues involved for understanding rightly this law for the wayward woman, suffice it to say here that recent studies have brought out the close connection, the similarity of language between the wayward woman law and the description of Israel's spiritual harlotries. Israel, the bride of Yahweh, would prove an unfaithful wife, a wife of harlotry, and eventually she would be made to drink the cup of judgment by the hand of her jealous husband, Yahweh God, whose name is Jealous, Exodus 34:14. So Nathan MacDonald is one scholar. He teaches at the University of Cambridge, and he actually, in a recent study, suggested that the figural interpretation of the wayward woman as Israel is the literal reading. And even in this study, he was preceded, of course, by the work of Mary Douglas. Now, by contrast, so we compare the Nazarite with the wayward woman. By contrast, the Nazarite is one who has close connections with the high priest of Israel. He is a Nazarite, male or female, who voluntarily aspired to Israel's highest calling, to be a special possession of Yahweh, a royal priesthood, and a holy nation. So he personifies this ideal of self-sacrificing consecration unto Yahweh God. And indeed, as I just said, the Nazarite's holy status went beyond even that of mere priests. The closest parallel to the Nazarite's holiness is that of the high priest himself. So let me give you some of the similarities here. The Nazarite shares the following commonalities with priests and with the high priest in particular. Number one, both are regarded as, quote, holy unto God, holy unto Yahweh. That phrase is said of both of them, Leviticus 21:6, Numbers 6:8. Both have wine, strong drink restrictions, Leviticus 10:9, Numbers 6:3. Both have restrictions in relation to their hair, Leviticus 10:6, Leviticus 21:5-10, and then Numbers 6:5. Both have death pollution restrictions, even for close family members, Leviticus 21:11, Numbers 6:6-7. And again, here the Nazarite far exceeds the restrictions for the regular priest and is comparable only to the high priest himself. And then a fifth parallel, both the high priest and the Nazarite are said to have a crown or consecration, Hebrew netzer, upon their heads, signifying their holy status to Yahweh. And that's Exodus 29, 6-7, Leviticus 21:12, Numbers 6:7. So you know the high priest wears the diadem, referred to as a netzer, holy unto Yahweh. That's the word used to describe the Nazarite's head. So whereas the wayward woman strays away from her husband to pursue, presumably, pleasure with another man, the Nazarite is a man or a woman who voluntarily vows to abstain from worldly pleasures in order to draw near to Yahweh God. So these are diametrically opposed paths. Now let's consider the Nazarite further by looking again a little bit about the three abstentions. So number one, the Nazarite would forgo all grape products, including wine. This abstention reflects forsaking earthly pleasures for a limited time in order to focus on the priority of one's relationship to Yahweh God as the chief delight in life. Now let me jump ahead and just note already how relevant this is for Israel in this particular historical context. The camp is about to journey through the wilderness to the promised land for a very specific set period of time. Scholars think it probably took about 2 weeks. And so the question is, how should Israel best approach this time in the wilderness, this limited time of deprivation? And I remind you, there's no grapes or grape products to be found in the wilderness. So Israel should approach the journey through the wilderness like a Nazarite, gladly forsaking the comforts and pleasures of life for a designated set period of time in order to follow Yahweh more closely, just as Jesus Christ himself did in the wilderness. Now in Numbers 13, clusters of grapes, remember, are a big part of this narrative. And Israel is reminded that yes, once God brings you into the land, even as Deuteronomy describes, you can eat meat, drink wine till your heart's content. But for now, isn't that goal worth a little bit of deprivation as you draw near to Yahweh himself? So then the second abstention, the Nazirite is also to avoid corpse pollution even for close kin. Now again, the restriction prioritizes one's consecration to Yahweh even above close family members. But also this law functions to give a remedy for corpse pollution, which is going to become integral to the narrative. You may understand that the book of Numbers is giving us, based off of Dennis Olson's fine work, the story of two generations. So the second generation will be need to be cleansed from the corpse pollution of the first generation. So this will be a big topic in the wilderness again. And then thirdly, finally, the Nazirite is to leave his or her hair unshorn. And the rationale is that the growth of hair day by day captures that period of abstention and consecration unto Yahweh. And then you want that period through the hair to be sacrificed to Yahweh as a gift to him. So moving on to the end of the Nazirite vow, the man or woman would be brought to the tent of meeting. And part of the final ritual involves a purification or sin offering that's found in Numbers 6:14. And this purification offering has been one of the great puzzles to exegetes throughout the centuries. Why does he need to give a purification offering? In other words, what sin has he committed? So Maimonides, for example, regarded the act of becoming a Nazirite, austerely forsaking worldly pleasures, to be the sin that required the purification offering. Nachmanides, on the other hand, thought the sin was to be found in forsaking the Nazirite vow in order to return to the world in all of its pleasures. So we got diametrically opposed views. As it turns out, neither of these is really adequate. The purification offering in 6:14, unlike the purification offering we see in verse 11, which was to cleanse him from corpse pollution, is here more general in nature. And here I would commend the work of Roy Gain, who's done significant work in this area. The purification offering in verse 14 is similar instead to purification offerings for services of ordination. So the ordination of priests, Exodus 29, Leviticus 8, the ordination of Levites in Numbers 8. And within these contexts of ordination, the purification offering has the sort of general cleansing necessary for a transition into a state of enhanced intimacy with God. That is, the purification offering accomplishes the general cleansing needed for an elevated, exceptional degree of sanctity. A sanctity that exceeds the previous status of holiness throughout the vow, because you didn't need a purification offering to become a Nazirite. So rather than a purification from undue asceticism or as some sort of desacralization for returning to the world, the Nazirite, through this purification offering, is being prepared for the culminating act of the Nazirite vow, the culminating priestly act of symbolic self-sacrifice, whereby he will place his hair on the fire under the peace offering, verse 18. So the Nazirite becomes both offering and officiant. Having dedicated himself to God by vow, he now offers himself and his life of consecration to God upon the altar by means of his hair. The long locks of hair, which had grown steadily day by day, encapsulate his daily rejection of the world for the sake of God, his daily living for the glory of Yahweh throughout the period of his consecration. And that Godward sacrificial life is now itself sacrifice, culminating in a final act of worship. Friends, what a foreshadowing of the Lord Jesus Christ, who after living an obedient life of self-sacrifice unto God the Father, he then offered himself up as the righteous and blameless one, sacrificing himself upon the cross of agony, offering himself up to God through the eternal Spirit. Indeed, Philo's eloquent statement on the Nazirite vow is justified. In Special Laws 1.248, he writes this, quote, "And when they," the Nazirites, "have no longer any materials left in which they can display their piety, they then consecrate and offer up themselves, displaying an unspeakable holiness and a most superabundant excess of a God-loving disposition, on which account such a dedication is fitly called the great vow. For every man is his own greatest and most valuable possession, and this even he now gives up and abandons." End quote. With good reason, then, one commentator has remarked that the Nazirite gift of self-sacrifice is, quote, "as close as the Israelite cult comes to human sacrifice." And incredibly, in Numbers 6:18, may, and I stress the word may, relate the only occasion where a non-priestly Israelite was permitted to ascend the steps of the altar and to place a sacrifice, his hair, upon Yahweh's flames. This is an action even forbidden to the non-priestly Levites. And of course, I stress the word may because it just seems so incredible, and yet it seems as if that's what he is doing himself. And I remind you that this holy status, comparable to the high priest himself, is available to any Israelite, male or female, and this is what is set forth before the people of God just as they're about to embark on the wilderness journey to the land of promise. And so, again, these purity laws do not describe a military camp. Those are different concerns completely. These purity laws are giving us the theology of life for the people of God, the covenant community. All right, so now we move finally to the third function of the purity laws. The purity laws function, number three, as a rationale for assessing Israel's camp throughout the wilderness sojourn. So from one perspective, especially the three main cases of the purity laws, they determine the behavior that is to be characteristic of the ideal covenant community. Again, things like confession of sin, fidelity in marriage, etc. But they also then designate the sort of behavior that marks you as an outsider. And we'll come to see that in a moment. In other words, the geographic boundaries of the camp reinforce theological boundaries, and it's the latter of which are applicable to God's people of every era. So for our purposes, I want to look at this from this angle. How do the purity laws help us to evaluate Israel's faithfulness, or perhaps better, lack thereof, within the wilderness sojourn? And note here that when I say wilderness sojourn, I'm thinking of chapters 11 through 25. That's the sojourn proper. And so what I want to do is just survey some of the texts found in that section and show how they relate to the purity laws. So beginning with Numbers 11. Numbers 11 opens with a sharp contrast to the book's first 10 chapters. Verse 1, the people complain. Verse 4, the mixed multitude craves a craving or desires a desire. And their lusting leads the people of Israel to weep and to ask, who shall give us meat, flesh, in the wilderness? And so they look back to Egypt. They remember the fish, cucumbers, leeks, etc. And they regret their own deliverance. They want to undo the Exodus itself. And I remind you, the people weren't even hungry. For at least a year, God had been faithfully feeding them manna every single day. He had been faithful. But Israel here then, this is a huge plunge into lust. Israel falls into this pursuit of pleasure. They want their extravagant appetites to be indulged in, of all places, the wilderness. And Yahweh assesses their behavior in chapter 11, verse 20, saying that Israel has despised Yahweh who is in your midst. And of course, in your midst is an allusion to the setting of the camp, Numbers 1 through 6. But for our purposes, clearly, rejecting Yahweh for the pursuit of pleasures within this limited time period of the wilderness is the antithesis, the exact opposite of the life set forth before Israel through the Nazirite vow. Let's look at Numbers 12. Here, Miriam slanders Moses, and she leads Aaron into sin as well. And in response, the Lord God censures Miriam with leprosy. So like leprosy, the evil tongue, slander, gossip, blasphemy, defiles others, in this case, Aaron. And of course, leprosy is an allusion to Numbers 5, 1 through 4, which we read a moment ago. For our sakes, nothing could more plainly declare that such behavior is unfitting for the people of God than to punish her with leprosy, because as a leper, what happens to her? She's shut out of the camp. This is a clear theological boundary. This behavior is not fit for the covenant community of God. So here again, we also see a correlation between purity concerns, ritual concerns, and moral purity and how they're interrelated. You behave this way, you become ritually unclean with leprosy. And then in Numbers 13 and 14, the first generation of Israel there refuses to inherit the land through unbelief and disobedience. Well, I noted earlier that the result of defilement for both the strayed woman and the Nazirite is described very specifically in Hebrew as falling away. So the Hebrew nafal, the woman's thigh falls away, the Nazirite's previous days of consecration fall away. Well, interestingly, only here, again, we have a description of judgment using that same language, twice, actually. Yahweh's judgment on the first generation of Israelites in the wilderness is phrased this way. So Numbers 14:29, the dead bodies of you who complained against me will fall and fall in this wilderness. And you get the same in verse 32. But moving on to a fourth example, looking at chapters 19 and 20. So in chapter 20 of Numbers, we have the second generation finally emerge. The only people left to die are the leaders. And so what happens in Numbers 20? It begins with the death of Miriam. It ends with the death of Aaron. In the middle, you have the threat of death, the sentence of death given to Moses. Well, interestingly, in the previous chapter, chapter 19, it's all about cleansing from corpse pollution through what is known as the red heifer ritual. And this is the same cleansing alluded to for the Nazirite to be cleansed from corpse pollution. It's just not given any details there. We have to wait till we get to 19. And so the new generation is being cleansed from the corpse pollution of the first generation, which serves to characterize this new generation in terms of the Nazirite, and that they need to focus again on forsaking the pleasures of the world throughout this limited time in the wilderness to pursue their relationship with Yahweh. A fifth example, in Numbers 21, the second generation fails by complaining. Yet like those who are required to make restitution for taking a false oath in Numbers 5:5-10, the people of Israel come before Moses and say, "We have sinned, for we have spoken against Yahweh and against you." Now, this I've mentioned in last night's lecture is a dramatic difference from the first generation. This is one of the few confessions of sin we find in the Pentateuch. And so the link to the ritual law in Numbers 5 and the need to confess sin is a very strong one. And it's a way for the text to say the second generation is living the sort of life solicited by the purity laws. And that's really how they function for the sake of the church. And I think that's the way you preach them, is they solicit a way of life that's applicable to us in every generation. All right, a sixth example in Numbers 22-24, of course, we have the Balaam story, which turns on whether Yahweh can be made to curse Israel or not. So there we have Balak, the king of Moab, is feeling threatened by the gathering camp of Israel. And so he hires the world's most renowned pagan prophet, Balaam, and he wants him to curse Israel. And of course, every time Balaam opens his mouth, he spews out blessings upon Israel. And Yahweh explains this in chapter 22, verse 12. He says, "You shall not curse the people because they are blessed." And that, of course, brings us back to the end of the purity laws, the priestly benediction, and the whole theology of Israel's camp. Through the priesthood, God had placed his name upon his people so that they were blessed. And interestingly, that priestly benediction in Numbers 6 and this narrative of Balaam in Numbers 22-24, these are the only two places in the entire book of Numbers where that root for blessing, Barak, is found. So again, linking the two pretty tightly. And then seventh, final example, in Numbers 25, many Israelites commit harlotry with the women of Moab and join themselves to Baal of Peor. And their apostasy is exemplified by Zimri, the Israelite, who brazenly takes Cozbi, a Midianite princess, into the camp before the eyes of Moses and all the congregation of Israel. Well, if we go back to Numbers 5, the resolution for the wayward woman begins when? When the spirit of jealousy, Hebrew kana, comes upon her husband. And that root jealousy is used 10 times in Numbers 5. Well, in Numbers 25, the resolution comes through Aaron's grandson, Phinehas, who is praised by Yahweh for being, quote, "jealous for my sake among them, so that I did not consume them in my jealousy." And the root kana is used there four times. Yahweh is the jealous husband, and his honor is preserved through the act of Phinehas. And again, Israel is likened to a spiritual harlot. Also, the strayed woman's judgment in Numbers 5 is said to reach her belly, Beten in Hebrew, and Phinehas' spear is said to reach Pierce Cosby's belly. In that case, it's Kobata in Hebrew, 25:8. So Phinehas' act of atonement essentially brings the wilderness sojourn to an end. As I pointed out last night, chapter 26 sort of restarts. You have a new census, and it's almost assumed that they're going to enter the land and inherit it. Everyone in that census is someone who is going to enter the land. There's no more trials, no more judgments, etc. And so Phinehas' great act of atonement brings an end to the wilderness sojourn. So in conclusion, I use that word advisedly, we have considered how the purity laws, one, reflect the new status of Israel as the camp of Yahweh, how the purity laws regulate the life of the camp, and how the purity laws serve as a rationale for assessing the camp's behavior throughout the wilderness sojourn. Well, needless to say, the Church of Jesus Christ is similarly called to live a life of purity, lives characterized by just dealings, confession of sin, marital faithfulness, even as the church is the bride of Christ. We are called to live coram Deo before the face of God, devoted to Him supremely. And in 1 Corinthians 5, the Apostle Paul explains the defiling nature of sexual immorality, covetousness, and the like. And these, he says, defile the church. And he bids the church to practice excommunication, not only for the person's own soul, but for the sake of the purity of the church itself. And so with the wilderness camp, behavior that is not in accord with godliness in the church also leads, should lead, to excommunication. But then turning to the eternal city of God, the New Jerusalem in Revelation 21, 22, we find many wondrous correspondences between Israel's camp and the city of God. I developed some of those yesterday, but there's also parallels between the purity laws of the camp and the description of the New Jerusalem. So just as the priestly benediction in number 6 sheds the radiance of Yahweh's face upon his people, placing his name upon them, pouring forth blessing upon the camp, so Revelation 22, 3 through 5 tells us that there shall be no more curse. They shall see his face, and his name shall be upon their foreheads. They need no lamp or light of the sun, for the Lord God gives them light. Now his name upon their foreheads reminds us of the high priest's diadem, but it also reminds us of the Nazarite. And just as Numbers 5, 1 through 4 begins with the expulsion of the unclean from Israel's camp, Revelation 21 declares that anything that defiles or causes an abomination like the unbelieving and the sexually immoral shall by no means enter the city of God. The purity of the camp, in other words, was but a dim reflection of the covenant community in glory in all of its beautiful purity. But maybe you caught, there's one notable difference. Whereas in Numbers, it describes an expulsion right out of the camp, with the New Jerusalem, in Revelation, we read rather of an entrance right. That is, nothing that defiles shall ever be able to enter the city of God. And that point should lead to an obvious question. How is it that any one of us can ever entertain hopes of entering God's eternal, pure city? Well, the book of Revelation answers that question in the person and work of the Lord Jesus Christ, the Lamb who, quote, loved us and washed us from our sins in his own blood, Revelation 1:5. Similarly, the author of Hebrews, who bids us to persevere into that eternal city of God, he compares Jesus to the red heifer ritual of purification in Numbers 19, which was slaughtered and burned outside the camp in order to cleanse those on the outside to make them fit to enter the pure camp. So Jesus, through the incarnation, left heavenly glory to meet us on the outside, to join us in humanity's exile from God. Jesus, that he might sanctify God's people with his own blood, suffered outside of the camp, bearing the reproach of sinners, so that in and through Jesus Christ, sinners may find perfect cleansing for life with God in glory. Amen.